Okay, we're starting. Hello, this is the John Jonas Knowledge Base. We're interviewing Joan Jonas today, discussing her exhibition, Joan Jonas Lifetime Tales at the Pirelli Hangar Bicocca in 2014-2015, which then traveled to the Malmö Kunsthall in 2015. Thank you very much, Joan, for taking the time to discuss this exhibition with us today. So we'll start out by the simple question, how did this exhibition come together? Who invited you and how did it all start?
I was invited by Vincente Tudorli, who is the director of Hangar Bicocca. And I had known him for many years before that and had been in a show that he did at in Sorrel. I had he had me make some minor theaters, big ones, to project some of the video works in that show. And so he invited me to be in the show. At the time, Andrea Lissoni was the curator of Hangar Bicocca. So right after, I can't remember the sequence exactly, but I met Andrea right after that in Italy. I remember we took a train together and immediately began talking. And so that's how it began. And Vincente had nothing, really wasn't involved at all in the curating. His only stipulation was that there not be any walls built in the space, and that the space be left open, which was a completely new situation for me and proved in the long run to be very interesting and productive as a way of showing my work. And there was just one room in the space that we left up at the end of the space as you came in. There was one enclosed room.
So to give our listeners an idea, the Pirelli Hangar Bicocca is a former airplane hangar. So we're talking about a very big, vast, very high space. Is that correct?
That's right. It's actually literally an airplane hangar. And I had seen it a few years earlier. Now I can't remember the name of the curator. She's now in Venice, was the curator of Hangar Bicocca. And I went to see a show there and she wanted me to do a show. And then she left Hangar Bicocca and went to a space in Venice. And so I remember that first show I saw. So I had an idea about what it was like. It was cavernous and dark, completely black. The floor and the walls and no light, but artificial light. And so I had an idea of the space.
And this was about, just to give our listeners a better idea, this was about 2 years before the opening of the show. So we're talking 2012, 2013, because I imagine it
probably
takes some time to prepare a show of such
Absolutely.
Retrospective, right? Of
such yeah. Size. Well, this was a big show. And It was different because the space was different. I'd had other survey shows, one at in Barcelona and Stuttgart, big survey shows, but I'd never had one in a space like this. And there were some newer pieces that were not in the other shows.
Right.
So the other curators and people that I worked with at Hangar Bicocca, Fia Mehta.
Micioli.
Yeah, and Matteo. Fia Mehta and Matteo. Matteo was the main installer and in charge of all the technology. He was very good.
Yes,
Fia Mehta was great.
Yeah, Matteo Di Vittor.
Yeah. And during the time that I was getting ready for the show, they put together a small brochure catalog, which was, had extensive, a little piece about each of the works that was in the show. So for the audience to take home and read. So there's quite a bit of information that went with the installation.
And that brochure, for our listeners also, that brochure is available on the Joan Jonas Knowledge Base. You can download it and look at that. And that's so people can see how, so people basically walk through the show with this little brochure in hand, because I imagine without there being walls, there were also not really wall labels. So people could really...
Well, there were labels, but you couldn't really find them so easily. Yeah. They weren't, right in front of you.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, where was I?
Yeah, maybe we can speak about, so you were asked to do the show, you saw the space, and then obviously you flew back to New York to your studio, and then you were in probably avid conversation with them. How did you start working on the show in your studio? Like, how did you?
Well, first of all, we chose which works that were going to be in the show. And many of the works that were in past shows, there was one show at the Queen's Museum, I forgot to mention, that had, that was a big survey show. And so we chose many works from those shows, as well as a few new works, which I'll talk about in a minute. But
you once said you had a model. You also, like, you made a choice.
Yeah, so the first thing I did after we decided which ones were going to be in the show, we made a huge model that was the size of a 4x8. Bigger than a 4x8 foot table, because the space was so big. And that really, I always make models for my big shows, for my survey shows, even my smaller installations. And they're very carefully planned out before moving in or before even deciding what to do in the space. And so I worked on that model, must have been for over a year. And I worked with my team in New York, but really it was, they had never seen the space, so I had to pretty much on my own. But they helped me build the model. And the concept of the show, there were several things about the space that, for instance, we couldn't have any, and there was no climate control. So whereas I would like to have the very early organic honey work, we couldn't have that because the Stedelijk wouldn't lend it. Because of the fragility of it. We couldn't have any unframed paper works or anything because of the atmosphere. But one of the ideas that Andrea brought to the work, to the installation, was his interest in a couple of works that I wouldn't have focused on. One of them was a piece called Waltz, a 7-minute piece that I can't remember, 2003, I think. And it's a piece I made up in Canada. And my dog is really the star. It's very much a kind of fantasy piece. And he liked it very much. So it was interesting because that became in my work, because he chose it to be in the show, became kind of a focal point, at least for me. It changed it altered. The trajectory, you know, the ideas and the content of it became more fantastical and mythological. And then I was asked to do a new piece just for the show. And so I made a work with my GoPro camera called Beautiful Dog, which was about my dog. The first waltz has my dog Sappho. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, not Sappho. Zina, who has a starring role. And Beautiful Dog has my dog, Ozu. And I made it with a GoPro camera. It's just another example of experimenting with media. And just to briefly begin talking about the order of works, the first part of the exhibit, you walked into an L-shaped room. The bottom part of the L was what you walked into, smaller. And then you walked to the right and you walked into a big, huge, not a corridor, but a rectangle, huge, that led back to the room with walls in the back. And so that was the space I was dealing with. And as you walked in, these newer pieces were, there was a piece called After Mirage, which is a circle of cones, which is a piece I had worked on in the 70s, but had just begun showing it again. And it's a circle of paper cones with a TV on its side with the video May Windows. So you walked, that was sort of the piece you walked into. And then to your left was a projection of Beautiful Dog. The dog, it was shot in Nova Scotia. And Waltz on another adjacent wall was Waltz. So that was kind of the atmosphere you walked into. And also in that space, the L-shaped space, was a piece I'd made in Japan using curved Soshi screens called Double Lunar Rabbit. And so those were the that was a group of works you saw first when you walked in. Double Lunar Rabbit was based on, I made it much more recently in Japan, 2014 or 15, I can't remember. And it was about the myth of the rabbit in the moon, that the Japanese, comes from the Japanese tradition. And I worked with the dancer who played the rabbit. Anyway, and then from there, you went into the longer room with the bigger installations. And that's how, so that was really, you know, I worked together with Andre on that, and that was his way of beginning the show. And then the rest of it, I'd totally planned out. And I had to make adjustments, of course, when we got to the space.
Right. I mean, we're talking a total of about 20 works, if we look at the exhibition brochure. So that was quite a lot of very big installations as well.
Well, no, but 20 works includes all the single channel works that were on monitors. Mm-hmm. It includes two or three minor theaters. Mm-hmm. So the big works, the huge works were, I just mentioned the first part, the shape, the scent, the feel of things, one part of reading Dante, Mirage, Lines in the Sand, Revolted by the Known Places, Volcano Saga, and Reanimation in the back room. So, and then there were, I don't know how many single channel works on monitors and minor theaters scattered throughout the space in the empty spaces in between the big works.
Also, Lines in the Sand was presented.
Yes, I mentioned that, yeah.
Which is, you mentioned that, and that's interesting also because Lines in the Sand is such a piece that I always felt that needed its more of an enclosed space. So some of the pieces maybe could kind of spill out into the space, and others maybe were more centered around, for example, in Lines in the Sand, the green wooden couch.
Can I say something about that?
Yes, please do. I'm wondering about that.
Lines in the Sand was designed as a frontal, to be seen frontally, on a platform in front of a projected screen. And it was shown exactly like that. So it didn't spill out in the space at all. Mm-hmm. There were no walls around it. So the main difference in a piece like that would be your perception of the sound. The sound turned out to be fine, but that was my main fear, that the sound wouldn't work. However, it did work finally in the end. But for a piece like Lines in the Sand, where you had to play it loud enough so you could hear all the subtleties, we worked quite a bit on the soundtrack with all these different sounds. Certain things like that were lost a little bit, but it really didn't interfere in the all over picture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that was probably also, there was also space between the installations, correct? There was really space.
Well, I'll
to
just
move.
Say, if, mm-hmm. I think if I talk about, if I look at the plan, and just walk, we'll jump, walk through the space.
Yes.
And I can speak about each piece in that way that you're asking me to. There was a projection to the right of Song Delay with a video monitor with Paul Revere that Richard Serra and I did together, which was also, had never been included before. Andre wanted to include that, which was great. And then a projection of Song Delay. Then the one piece that did kind of exist a little spread out, but nothing was that much bigger than it would have been in another space, except for Mirage maybe. But the shape, the scent, the feel of things, I needed a place to put a large drawing of Snake, a big, huge drawing, and then big projections. So what happened in the show is that the screens served as both dividers in a transparent way because they were back projected or they had a projection, so they weren't like walls, but they acted as dividers. And then we put up a wall with the Snake drawing on one side and a projection on the other, so there were elements, architectural elements. The screens became architectural elements, I would say, in the piece. Well, then you walk through, it was all about also walking through the pieces. So the shape, the scent, the feel of things existed kind of at an angle in the middle of the space as you walk in the long, bigger part, and you walk through it and in it, which you would anyway, but you walk around it. In other words, if it was in a room, you wouldn't walk around these screens. So you got a very different experience. And then there was a freestanding screen called, from reading Dante, chalk drawing, street scene. Just one element of that. And then Mirage, which also, I would say, now it's showing at MoMA. I think in this space, it had a slightly bigger feeling, but it was almost, yes, I'd say exactly the same, except the screens were freestanding. And the big screen with the volcano footage projected on it for Mirage, you could see as you walked in the room on the other side of the shape, the scent, the feel of things.
Right. Was,
and so things like that happened, which were really worked because there was a relationship in content between all the works, you know, there's a relationship.
Yes.
And what I did was also very carefully, the arrangement of the pieces has to do with Mirage has very abstract sounds. It has a little bit of talking from documentary footage, but basically abstractions. The shape has quite a bit of text and dialogue, and Lines in the Sand has text and dialogue, but they're separated by Mirage, so they don't interfere with each other. And so then you walk by the lines and you see, there are also drawings on panels, another kind of separation, big drawings that belong to Lines in the Sand, but they can't, we couldn't put things right up against the walls because they weren't that, there was, this is a black curtain dividing the Hangar Bicocca space. On the other side of the black curtain is Anselm Kiefer's huge installation, which is not in sight. It's off and has no sound. So anyway, so we had to build, we had to either use screens or panels for the drawings. And then we go to Revolted by the Thought of Known Places. The Stedelijk also owns that. And whenever that's any of the pieces that they own are in a show, they send their curators to install it. They're very nice people. I knew them because I've been there so much. We rearranged it for the, I'd say that piece was much more radically rearranged, yes, than any other piece, but not changed at all. All the same video projections and monitors and props. You know, there are props also, props and objects scattered, yes, in these works throughout the space. Then after that was Volcano Saga, mm-hmm, also freestanding in the middle. And then all along where there's a Mainu theater at the end of the room. And then Reanimation is in a room, which, right, was lucky because the sound of Reanimation would have interfered. You know, there would have been too many pieces with very elaborate soundtracks. Reanimation has sound. You know, A Shape the Scent has Jason Moran's piano playing. Reanimation, yes, has some of his sounds and other sounds, and so on.
Yeah, I must have. We've done a few interviews with scholars and curators and people who saw the show, and they felt also that there was a really very specific moment of constantly being surprised, but at the same time, you were also guided by the sound and by, for example, the composer and the music of Jason Moran that would then again reappear in Reanimation. So I imagine the work on the sound was very detailed and very elaborate.
Well, what we did was, I mean, of course, I had to just make the sound as good as possible. And I have to give Matteo credit for, you know, the sound is always the last thing that you tweak. And so we worked on, I really enjoyed installing a show because it was also a good exercise to walk from one end of the room to the other. It's a very long walk. But I really enjoyed, the team was just the best. And it was the same team that I then got to work on my show and for the American Pavilion, a team from Torino, plus Matteo. Anyway, so it was totally enjoyable experience. And we got the sound to a certain point. It was still bleeding quite a bit, but after we all went home the night before the opening, Matteo went around and tweaked the sound. And I came in the next day and it really worked because the trick was to play the sound low in all the pieces, but loud enough for people to hear, of course. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't be very loud, but also you would hear it faintly. So yes, it would lead you to another piece, but also what led you from one work to another, you could see the next piece as you were walking through. So you could always see all the others in the distance, you know, or next to you. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it was a kind of flowing a flow. The piece created a flow, which mm-hmm. other works didn't have when they're walls. So that was interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think that also really leads us to, I mean, you've talked about how you've slightly were able to adapt some of the pieces and in the sense of spacing, but even not so much. Do you feel there was something that in hindsight where you felt, if you could go back and add a piece, or if you could have taken out or changed something about it, was there ever something that you felt like you would have maybe in hindsight made differently, or?
No.
No. Okay.
No, I don't. No, I worked really hard and, you know, for a long time on figuring this much out. Mm. And it worked as well as I thought it could have worked.
I also I feel that, for example, the work you're working on right now off the land is a piece that I could so well imagine. I'm saying this because I could so well imagine other of your works that you've done since then who could have also been, you know, subsequently would make sense to also have in that space. There's something of an openness to it.
Of course, but there would be no room for anything else.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. It would have to be a completely different show. But mm-hmm. moving off the land might be something, or, yeah.
I mean, you've said before that you've never had a situation like that before and after. And when you move, when the exhibition traveled to Malmö, which is also a large open space, but a very different type of space, what changed? What did you have to adapt?
Well, it just looked very different. It was the floor at Malmö made a huge difference. It was a beautiful light wood floor, wood from the north on the floor. Mm-hmm. And that it just looked different. I can't describe it. Mm-hmm. And we just had to slightly change the positions of the different pieces. I don't remember, frankly, because I don't have a plan of Malmö. So Malmö, I just really, Andrea came with me, and I think we planned it beforehand for sure. But I didn't make a plan. I didn't make a model for Malmö, so I don't have it before me to see what we did. I think we changed the position of certain things for sure, because it was a different. It was also a big rectangle, but I think we also left out some things. We didn't. It wasn't as big, but I don't remember. But it was a very beautiful space, Malmö. Barbara.
Yes, and sorry, and Reanimation also had its own room in Malmö.
I guess it did, yeah. Yes. Did you see that show?
Yes, I did see. I was able to see.
Oh, then you probably remember it better than me.
Yeah. I think it had. Yeah. It was very similar to the setup of the newer works and this kind of walking through the show, and the sound was also very finely tuned.
Right.
Diana Balden, who's the curator there, was showed me around the show at that time in 2015, and the Reanimation was also in a separate space behind, but in general it was held.
That's right.
Apparently it had a similar feel to it.
Interesting.
I was wondering how did this show, this experience, and obviously having an open vast space is not something an artist is gifted with all the time, but still, how did this show influence other shows afterwards, or how did it influence your thinking around space and installation? Did it?
I don't know if it changed my thinking, because each time I do a show, I make a model and I totally adjust. Like the next show I did after that was the show in Venice at the American Pavilion. But I would say one big help was that I decided to work with the same crew in Venice that I'd worked with in Milan. Who are incredible. Mm-hmm. And so some of those people I'm still working with mm-hmm. sometimes who I'd met there. Mm-hmm. And so they worked with me in Venice. I knew they would do a perfect job. You know, Venice is very difficult to work in. Everything has to come by boat and so on. There's always a lot of problems, but there was no problems. They're Italian and they could do it. So Venice, as you know, is a complete, a building with,
was the opposite?
Five rooms, you know, walls, and very, very kind of classical and a little claustrophobic, but it was interesting to try to solve. That was another problem, completely different.
Yes.
So
yes, maybe we can speak a bit about programming. When you go on, for all our viewers, when you go on the Pearly Hanger Bikaka website, you see that they really invest a lot in different types of programming and younger artists, local, international artists. But also, they really, I think they made also a huge effort to perform Reanimation. Can you speak about that? Because I think
we performed Reanimation in that front part where the cones were in the first part of the. When I say you walk in and you see the after mirage, the cones and the dog videos. And so that was easy to clear that out. We set up the stage in that. It's even that is a very big space. And we set up the stage there. I think 600 people came to see that performance. Mm-hmm. And so Jason and I did that performance on they built a stage for it. And we did it once. And yeah, I realize, of course, that sound is so important in a space like that, which is huge, and the people in the back can't see very well, but they can hear the sound. So Jason, of course, played live at that performance. It was the performance of Reanimation, which we'd done before several times in different places. And that was the only thing that I did in relation to the programming. I, of course, because I don't live in Milan, so I wasn't there for the duration of the show. So I didn't see all the programming that they did. But yes, they keep the space alive throughout all the shows by programming other works of younger artists.
It's also an interesting instance because, correct me, but it's one of the few instances where you actually also perform in the same space as you exhibit, which normally is something you do not do. Is that right?
I do not do, but I mean, I'll just say, what I say is I do not perform in my installations.
Exactly.
So this was the situation in which they could clear part of the space and take out the work, the cone piece, which was simple to move. They could take it out and we could perform in that empty, and then it became an empty space with the only things there were videos on the walls. So that became a big empty space. So I performed, but I wasn't performing in the installation. I was performing in the space that had been cleared, part of the space that had been cleared. Right. It's such an enormous space, you could do that. Which is unusual.
And I think that's an important point. Also, in regard to the publication, I know that at the same time as this show was presented, as exhibition was presented, a big monograph edited by you and John Saman came out, and it kind of accompanied this exhibition.
No, it doesn't. No, it came out. Like late in the installation in Venice,
okay,
in the U.S. Pavilion, in the Biennale, came out during that.
Oh, okay, because
it was co-published by Hanger Bikaka.
Yes,
but it wasn't ready. Right. And then when it came out, they wanted to include photographs of the show in the book, and there are photographs, of course. Of the Hanger Bikaka show in the book.
Yes.
And that was one of the reasons that it couldn't come out earlier.
Yeah. I think it came out at the end of Malmö because I got my copy.
No, it didn't. It didn't come out until, because it has photographs of the Venice piece as well.
Oh, yeah.
So
interesting.
Joan Simon didn't want it to come out before Venice. She wanted to include Venice. So it got delayed quite a bit and came out. After
later,
Venice opened.
But it documents the exhibition. And maybe that brings us to one of the final questions do you ever have guidelines or do you ever think about documenting your exhibitions? And did you have instructions?
Of course, often I video my own exhibitions, but I just have to trust lately. I used to kind of have a little more control or attention. But there's just so much you can do. So I trust now, of course, the institutions to get a good camera person and photograph the work extensively, better than I could. Mm-hmm. And also, I would like people to walk through the video camera, but they don't often do that. I did a GoPro walkthrough of the installation as we were not the final show, but of the process when we were halfway through. I walked through with my GoPro, and that is somewhere online. I don't know where I saw it.
Yes.
But yeah, I think it would be good to have video, but sometimes I just don't have time and I don't get around to it.
Yes. We'll come to a close now, but I'd like to, is there anything you still want to add or you still want to say about?
Let me just see if we've covered all.
I think we've covered pretty much all. I think we'll do with the advice for curators in the future. Is there anything you wanted to?
Advice for curators in the future. Really study the way I've put these together in the past.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think that's the best thing.
Yes. Yes.
Because, for instance, with the Stedelijk show, I spent with Doreen Mignot a month setting up the organic honey piece and the Sweeney piece. It was extensively documented by their restoration team.
Yes.
And so when they install that, there's very specific directions and plans for how it should be done.
And
so I would say that.
And those are also on the Joan Jonas knowledge base. The Stedelijk very generously, just as MoMA and Milan have shared all this material.
Good.
So people can really find that on the knowledge base.
I mean, at some point, a piece just reaches a point where it's not going to be changed anymore. So the installation at MoMA now of Mirage, it's exactly the way it should be. And it's contained in a room. It could be set up like that, you know, in a place like Hangar with no walls, but the configuration would be exactly the same.
Right. Well, is there anything you want to add or?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
I would just add one more thing.
Yes.
And just mention it briefly.
Do.
The perception of my work for the audience was altered in the Hangar Bicocca, because it was the first time they had ever been able to see works in the distance, to be able to see projections in another piece next to the piece that they were standing in, so that you could see the relationship of the works to each other. And so it was a different kind of experience than walking in one room and one piece is just contained, and then you walk into the next room and then you see that piece, but you don't see these pieces layered. And I think that's a very different way of experiencing my work, and I like it very much, but probably never again.
Yeah.
Will it be like that?
Yeah. I think that's really a great way to finalize why this exhibition was so important.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.